Hi, everyone. Lucas Werner here. If you've been enjoying these conversations about art and culture, you might want to check out the newest releases from David Werner Books, where we've published award-winning titles on D.N. Arbus, Yayoi Kusama, and Kerry James Marshall, in addition to Ekphrasis, the critically acclaimed series of texts on art. This season, look out for books from the likes of Catherine Bernhard, Noah Davis, and Marcel Zama, as well as new additions to the beloved Ekphrasis series. Visit davidswernerbooks.com to learn more.
Yeah, hi, I'm Edmund Frank. I'm an editor of the New York Review of Books Classic series, as well as the editorial director of New York Review Books.
From David Werner, this is Dialogues, a podcast about artists and the way they think.
Books have always said to readers, here I am, and you have time for this. There's time, the relationship with the book is time with oneself as well as with the book. I mean, it's always been as a certain kind of, in fact, luxury item, in the best sense of luxury.
I'm Lucas Werner, and every episode features a conversation. We're taking artists, writers, philosophers, designers, and musicians and putting them in conversation with each other to explore what it means to make things today. This week's guest is Edwin Frank. Edwin is a writer, and he's the editorial director of the New York Review of Books Classics imprint, the journal's influential publishing arm, and one of the great success stories of publishing more generally over the past decade or two. Founded by Edwin in 1999, the mission of the NYRB Classics is to reintroduce out-of-print gems to a new audience, not unlike the way a curator can put an older artwork into a contemporary context. Edwin has dug up and discovered all sorts of forgotten treasures over the years, like three novels by the great writer John Williams, which were overlooked, but one of which, Stoner, has gone on to become an international bestseller in many different languages, or Chekhov's unpublished stories, or a fascinating work of journalism by Janet Malcolm. The imprint really runs the gamut, and the books are incredibly popular and have a simple yet magnetic look. And I have to admit that the NYRB Classics, Edwin's brainchild, really is the inspiration for our own Ekphrasis series, which is bringing back into print writing about art that has been overlooked. In fact, we just celebrated our 20th edition with the publication of Virginia Woolf's Ode to Be a Painter, a collection of her rarely published writings on art and artists. So, Edwin, to start off with, I was curious if you could take us back in time a little bit to the early days or the early year or the year before the launch of the New York Review of Books publishing imprint.
Well, I made a pitch, but it was also in some sense organic. The New York Review, the periodical, had been publishing books intermittently through most of its life. It was first founded in 1963. And particularly during the Vietnam War, a lot of the review's audience developed during the war because of its strong anti-war coverage. And so there was, in some sense, a kind of almost pamphleteering spirit to those publications to put out various writers associated with the review's takes on the war or on the civil rights movement and things like that. So there was that in the background. And a little bit before that, some of the Bob Silvers had begun to collect sometimes more extensive pieces that added up, pieces by a given contributor that added up to a kind of book. And some very famous books, which were not published by the review, like, for example, Susan Sontag's On Photography, originally appeared in the pages of the review. So it had by you know, the 80s and 90s, a reputation for having published, not just articles, but books in a sense. So that was all there. The NYRB as a publishing project actually grew much more out of a different program that was, started by Jason Epstein, who had been married for a long time to Barbara Epstein, one of the founders of the review, and was the head editor at Random House for a while. which was basically a sales. It was a giant kind of catalog bookstore called the Reader's Catalog. And I started working for that freelance in mid-90s. I mean, and I guess there is a sort of important context here because it also contributed to the opportunity that then arose, which was that nowadays we have a slight, at least in major urban centers, a kind of rebirth of the independent bookstore and people. And but in the late 80s, you saw an almost a collapse of independent bookstores. Which was associated with the initial rise of the superstores like Barnes & Noble, Borders, some of them, of course, already things of the past. With that in mind, Jason was thinking that there'd be people here, there, and yonder around the country who no longer really had access to a decent bookstore. So the Reader's Catalog was going to be a Sears catalog for those readers. So it was going to be the 40,000 best books in print, it advertised itself as being. And you could browse through it, and you would see, just as you could browse the shelves of a bookstore, and there was light annotation here and there to say, you know, this is perhaps so-and-so's best novel, this is the most important study of this subject, that sort of thing. So that was the idea. And people were, and it was, you know, it was like a bookstore. You were meant to sell books through it. And what I had gotten involved with this project, Reader's Catalog, in its second iteration. One catalog had been printed, another one was going to be done. And the difference between the two catalogs, one big difference, was that the first one had not been computerized. So the second one was computerized with access to books in print. So basically any book that was not in print was excluded. So going through it, as my job was, it was quick. I basically could almost automatically generate a list of interesting books that were out of print. And then the proposal was maybe we should put them back in print.
So what was that like in the early years? Was it a couple books a year? Like how did it take shape and grow?
Yeah, it was touch and go, as startups of any sort are to begin with. But a good thing is that basically we went kind of all out from the beginning. That is to say, we started with a list of 20 to 25 books, which is a fair number. And yeah, there was the distinct chance that those 20 or 25 books would sit in the warehouse for all time, because you have to. What we didn't so much have at the beginning, or hadn't really, I mean, nobody involved with this had been intensely involved in book publishing. Everybody was figuring out his or her way, their way, and at the time. And so issues like, you know, which are crucial to a successful book publishing program, like distribution, publicity, marketing, these were all sort of up in the air when the first book sort of rolled off the press. But we had arranged for the rights of some 20 or so books, and two of them did pretty well from the very beginning, notwithstanding the total lack of adequate infrastructure, which I think amazed everybody.
Do you remember which two? I mean, presumably you do, since they came to mind.
Yeah. Well, the two, nominally the first book in the series was a reprint of book of late Chekhov stories and novellas that Edmund Wilson put together for Anchor Books back in the 50s. And that was partly, Jay Stepstein had been the editor of Anchor Books, so it was sort of a nod to that connection. And Wilson was an important critic for me and other people around there too. But the two books that sort of surprised us by doing well from the beginning were Richard Hughes's A High Wind in Jamaica, and then J.R. Ackerley's My Dog Tulip, one of the great a memoir of a dog, which was a very, very bad dog, really. and didn't have a very, very good owner either. It's a book that people either, dog owners either love or they think it's just outrageous.
Oh, that sounds great. I haven't read that one though. And was it clear? I mean, it was clear that you guys were going to do, I mean, reprints. Now, of course, it's broadened, and there are newly published. I mean, Josh Cohen's new novel was published by you. I mean, that happens more frequently. Mm-hmm. But what kind of editorial vision did you have, if any, besides what appealed to you, as it were, when you were first constructing the list out of, I'm sure, the thousands of books that were out of print, into, let's say, the 20 to 25 a year?
The popular term curation, which I don't really like all that much, but there is a way, which I did spend a lot of time I was pursued an art history degree for years and didn't get it. But I had thought a lot about museums and about showing the past to the present and the relationship between the past and the present. And so that was certainly something on my mind. And on my mind, even in the sense of one of the reasons I wanted to get out of academics is that kind of vital interchange between the past and the present that to me it felt artists always had. Cézanne looking at Poussin, if you will, and so on, was something that academia actually, with its kind of compartmentalization, really discouraged. It isolated. That way of thinking about things was very much in my mind. And so, to be a little bit pretentious, I wanted the series to be a kind of heuristic. I wanted myself to find out things through editing the series, and I wanted other people to find out things. I did not want it to be, and was in some sense opposed to the notion of calling it classics, a set of, recognizable properties that all had assumed a known position in the classroom or something like that.
Right.
But instead, things that were good or raised the question of really were they good? Old books that were in a way new. Or
right. New. Right. It's interesting because, as you say, museums have done quite a good job, all things considered, in branding the past, as it were, as something that is relevant to the present, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, increasingly today, you have people swarming into museums to look at both the recent past and the ancient past as it bears on the present. And that really doesn't feel like something that, as a rule, publishing has done a particularly good job at generating, right? A sense that there is novelty in the past, let's put it that way, right?
Yeah.
And it feels like, and maybe that's not true, that it's still the case that for most publishers, the emphasis really is on the new, right? As much of the new as possible. Do you feel that way when you look out at, the landscape today, or really how it has, as it's developed in the past two decades, that it is still very much kind of this front list or focus on the new, or to the exclusion of other things that could fit the mold?
Well, it's changed a little bit. And I think we both benefited from and have helped to foster the change in some ways. But I always think of a point along the way when we began, it was inconceivable that a new paper, frankly, it was inconceivable that a paperback would be reviewed in what was still then a much more robust world of print reviews. I mean, at that point, the newspaper in Raleigh still had a book page, and San Francisco Chronicle had a really excellent book, had something the same size as the New York Times Book Review now, and so on. So there was, in a way, many more reviews. And yet it was inconceivable that a paperback, and certainly a paperback of a reprint, would get certainly anything more than the most fleeting, mention.
And to just ask a stupid question, and that is basically because the principle there was you only review a new book, right? Newly written book that is printed in hardcover, as all the best new books ought to be, supposedly, or... That was how publishers signaled seriousness.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it was both a mixture of calculation and also there's also a certain, like, this is often the case with various forms of calculation. The calculation hit a certain kind of practicality, hit a certain kind of idealism. Because back in the day, in effect, sure, those book reviews depended on advertising, as you know, and the advertising was going to come for new books from big new publishers.
That is the world we live in the art world. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
On the other hand, there was a certain robust sense that the new books coming out were really going to, the array of offerings made by those publishers would somehow map out, really were pointing to some sort of broad new world where things were to be found out. And there was a certain forward lookingness. And so, it's interesting to me that what I was going to say is there's this moment when the Nation came, and the one of our books, very much a reprint, not a book that was newly translated or anything like that, had the lead of the back of the book, a 3-page article about William Lindsay Gresham's Nightmare Alley. And that seemed to me that had been inconceivable, not only in the pages of the Raleigh paper, but even in the pages of the Nation, which is a more rarefied audience, inevitably. So there was some change in the attitude of the audience towards your question about the past of the books as well as the present of the books. And suddenly the past was in play. Now, why that should be, I mean, I have theories, but it's an interesting shift.
You're tempting me. So now I have to ask I feel similarly, not only because of our, you know, Ekphrasis series, which basically is inspired by your series and looks specifically at art texts that fall off the beaten path, but I'm curious why you think that there is this cultural shift toward a renewed interest in things of the past, as it were, at least these in this specific category.
Well, I think one theory I have is that the readership, on the one hand, books are challenged by a lot of other forms of information or content, as we say these days, and whether it's a question of entertainment or whether it's a question of actually, you know, of information. There are, you know, there are good TV shows, there's social cachet of certain TV shows is just as great as having read one of the presidential biographies or what you will. So that I think means you have a diminished readership in a way for books, but perhaps a readership which is somewhat more sophisticated. Those people who remain attached to books, because books bring them something that only books can bring them. And they probably remain attached because they are aware of books as a traditional item, as something that goes back to a deep past and is and so there's that involved in it as well. The other thing I wonder is whether there isn't, I was thinking the other day about in light of something else I'm doing that, you know, for the last two centuries, the notion of the century has been very important. At the end of the 19th century, novels are full of people talking about the 19th century, which is really, as an idea, kind of a 19th century invention anyway. And the 20th century was full of awareness of it's not going to be the 19th century, and it wasn't the 19th century and so on. But I'm not so sure that in the 21st century, we live in a kind of post-century world. We're just sort of a wash in the new. And the new loses its authority when it's everywhere, you know, when it's sort of like the new becomes sort of like old bathwater. So I don't know. I mean, in some sense, certain past things stand out. You know, they're kind of equivocal monuments. They're not, again, I don't see people rushing back to read Dickens, which is a pity because Dickens is really, really great and new.
Right.
But I do, it is curious that they look at books like ours, which are, you know, sort of, which are new, in a way, because people have forgotten about them,
right?
But which then have peculiarly have a certain authority by virtue of being old, new,
right? That's very interesting.
It's a funny psychological process.
It's basically you're kind of getting both. You know, you're getting new and old in one. Yeah. You know, which is it's, and I think that's the, you know, it adds a contemporary spin or something. Yeah, I find. I mean, listen, we in visual art, that's not old hat, but we absolutely see that happening all the time. You know, that an artist who is been dead for many years could get paired with another artist or put in a different context or simply shown in a museum where we're used to seeing other things.
Yeah.
And suddenly that juxtaposition or, you know, that kind of jarringness makes it all seem completely new again. Like the idea of recontextualizing is an idea that's, I think, ingrained in the way visual art is even intuitively understood by your average viewer. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Well, I think it's the formal immediacy too of the visual arts in a way, but yeah.
Well, so that was, it's funny you say that. I wanted to ask that next, which is, you know, you talked about losing audience to these other media, right? These other possibilities. And of course, those are much easier to interact with. By easier, I mean, they are much more immediate, right? And that counts for visual art, which has also seen a huge audience growth in the last 10 years, I would say, just in terms of its proliferation or people's awareness of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that in part has to do with the ease of consumption. I mean, great artists should be known by as many people as possible, but as a whole, you know, we're looking at images and we process images very, very quickly and easily. And you said before that the reading public is looking for something specific to books. And I'm curious if you would try to characterize what that specific or media, you know, more mediated experience, as it were, is compared to what can be a very rich immediate experience that you get from a great piece of art or even a great television series, right? But it is different in kind somehow. And it would be interesting to hear, as someone who has seen the way the world is going, but has spent so much time pursuing publishing and books in particular.
Yeah.
You know, what distinguishes that experience?
That's an interesting question. And, you know, the traditional answer, and the answer that's become, you know, a kind of raging cliche in our society is storytelling. And there is a certain notion that the story will be as magnetic in some sense as, you know, I don't know, Velázquez's Venus. Can't take your eyes away from it. And of course, there's truth. Storytelling is, there's a great pleasure in storytelling, though that use of storytelling elides all the complications of different ways stories can be told, because part of the pleasure of storytelling is seeing how people tell stories differently. But it is, I think, for mainstream publishing, still very much a focus, and a focus which has now been taken into nonfiction. But when it comes to the books we publish, some of them are wonderful stories and you know, kind of something like, I mean, like, what's his name? Rogue Mail, a great book that we did by Jeffrey Household, which is, you know, pure suspense from beginning to end, completely delicious. So I'm not saying we wouldn't do that. But there is another interest which I think comes with books, which is going to have a smaller audience, and that is an interest in voice. And that finally is an interest in the question of individuality.
Yep.
And the freedom to say certain things, and also in the problems that come with that too. And I think that reading, which inevitably does take more time, is in that sense a reflective both exposure to voice and to the questions it raises, and a way of composing one, for the reader to compose his or herself in relation to of that. He takes like Virginia Woolf in The Common Reader. She's writing about the books that matter to her, but she is also in some sense trying to float a notion of readership, which is as important as great writership in a curious way. It is no writer without a reader, and no reader without a writer, really. So it's a dependency.
Yeah. You know, for those people that are sort of less familiar with what it means to find great books that are out of print, it's a sort of more general question, but how can it be? How is it possible that certain things fall out of print that are clearly have such a dedicated and interesting readership, right? And I mean, you've had a number of books, I would imagine, you know, that you rediscovered. I mean, one thinks about Stoner, you know, John Williams is basically a household name among readers at this point because of Stoner, and then Butcher's Crossing and Augustus. And I mean, all three of the novels are, in each of their genres, incredible pieces of work. And I'm just curious, again, there is no one reason, and market dynamics determine certain books don't sell and they fall out of print, etc. But, you know, from your perspective, how does it happen that something that has a life then no longer has a life?
Well, I mean, they're the things, but these are, then we're talking about things that then came back to life, sort of, serendipitously or whatever. I mean, obviously there are books that just date.
Right.
I mean, I think these days, for example, of a writer who meant a great deal to me in my 20s, Milan Kundera, who I still enjoy looking at, but who I also think in some ways just, maybe, I may be wrong, but there are ways when I look at Kundera, I think, you know, this is a great writer for a certain moment, and which isn't necessarily a bad thing to be. it's actually fairly astonishing to be a great writer for most places, in some sense, to be a great writer. But I mean, in the case of somebody like Williams, you're talking about a writer who really did everything wrong in his moment.
Interesting.
In the sense that writing three novels over almost as many decades and each of them a totally different kind of novel is an excellent way not to have a successful career. And then, you know, to have, in a way, your finest novel be about, you know, an unsuccessful and slightly pathetic academic in Missouri is also. But it is fascinating, though. What's more difficult to say is why do books suddenly wake up, or why do people wake up to books in ways that they, you know, never had before? You know, there's no question. I mean, that's a very moving book, but why it should have, you know, sold millions of copies around the world now.
It's actually crazy if you think about it. It's like, it's a book about a failed academic that, you know, I don't know when you guys published it, that has now sold millions of copies around the world.
Yeah, and ultimately a more enthusiastic audience abroad than in America, because it's done very well in America too, but it's not done the kinds of things it's done in Israel and in Holland and in, you know, and in China. And I don't know, you know, I mean, I think it has something to do with how people think about it in America. Mm-hmm. And you know, and in a curious way, somebody else pointed out to me, excuse me, but quite correctly, it is in a way an American existential novel. It's a sort of, I mean, it's an American outsider, albeit. So it has that. It also has a certain kind of Edward Hopper-ish sort of long shadowed American melancholy, which has always had a kind of international appeal.
You know, in my kind of last question, which is related to the success of something like Stoner, but also of many of the books on the list, is, I mean, I assume, I know that your audience is growing, and that there is a larger and larger readership for your list. And I'm wondering about your feelings generally, not so much about publishing, but just about how books are disseminating themselves, communicating with younger people. Like, so sort of what you're noticing and seeing as a publisher, in the world of readers?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there is, as I said before, a kind of forward-looking nostalgia for books in a way. And I mean, books, you know, you have to always figure that one of the things, going back to your question about the relation to the visual arts, you know, people have to work to look at paintings as long as you can actually look at a painting for that. And that too, you have to go against your grain. And people are, as you say, impatient with the amount of time that books take. But on the other hand, one of the things that books have always said to readers is, here I am, and you have time for this, which is something that makes a reader feel that, there's time to be a person in a curious way. There's time, the relationship with the book is time with oneself as well as with the book. I mean, it's always been as a certain kind of, in fact, luxury item, in the best sense of luxury. Books have always said, you know, you've had time, right? And education, which of course takes time too, in order to take things into consideration. So I think that appeal is, if anything, more keenly felt than ever before. And though we all know, you know, we buy books that we never do read, those are hopes for a time that never comes in a curious way. Actually, that's a perfectly respectable thing to do.
Absolutely. Also, those are, yeah, they're, again, the key word there seems to be hopes, right? That's an optimistic gesture. You're buying the book in hope of a positive time.
Yeah.
In which you will spend that time reading the book, right? Which it's a hopeful gesture. It's nothing wrong with that. I agree.
Yeah. So I think that there is very much part of the moment and part of this both kind of prospective and retrospective character that mark the moment or seem to mark the moment. And I mean, I think from younger readers, this is something it has been so much the case. It wasn't yet the case when I went to college that you have to prepare so endlessly. In fact, your time is taken away from you, even as you get to enjoy the 4 years of college, which, you know, which is certain time away from the job that you may never have again.
Right.
But it's been, I mean, the level of preparation and test taking and a credential, credential acquiring and so on has become, I think, fairly exhausting to people. So I think one thing that young people coming out of college look for is a place to hunt around in and discover things which they were not told to do or don't have to do. And I hope that to some extent, that's sort of like a big chest with full of different costumes. That's what the series can provide to people.
I have to say that sounds like a really nice note to end this conversation on. And, you know, thank you for talking to me, but also thank you so much for what you're doing, Edwin. It's a beautiful work, labor of love, and more than a labor of love, because it's a labor with a huge audience, a global audience, and one that is deeply appreciated. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Lucas. Thank you.
Dialogues is produced by David Zwirner. You can find out more about the artists on this series by going to davidzwirner.com/dialogues. And if you liked what you heard, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It really does help other people discover the show. I'm Lucas Zwirner. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you join us again next time.